This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Governor Rick Scott set the tone for this legislative session with a speech focused on jobs. The word jobs mentioned 32 times. Scott highlighted young entrepreneurs, talked about tax cuts, and properly embarked on a bus tour of the state to talk about more jobs. Scott got plenty of applause for his speech, but the reaction from the Democratic Party lawmakers was not quite so friendly. Senator Athenia Joiner said Scott has, quote, never quite understood that running state government is very different than running a big hospital corporation, end quote. Joiner went on to say there are two Floridas. Here's how she described Rick Scott's vision of the state.
If you live in Scott world, his Florida of mansions and yachts and private jets, yes, he most certainly has. If you happen to be on his hand-picked list of business winners, the ones he favors with your tax dollars for all their tax breaks, then yes, you've got the best governor money can buy.
Then Joiner said there's the other Florida, one filled with, quote, frustrated but hard-working people working two, sometimes three jobs. Is Joiner's picture of two Floridas a reality check for the governor? Which Florida do you see? While the governor talked plenty about jobs, what about everything else he didn't talk about? The environment, education, healthcare? We're taking your calls 1-866-338-5252. And joining me in the studio, Matt Reed, editorial writer with Florida Today and host of The Matt Reed Show. Welcome back, Matt.
Hey, thank you for having me, Matthew.
We're also joined by Maria Padilla. She's editor of Orlando Latino Blog. Welcome back, Maria.
Thank you, Matthew.
And joining us by phone, Daryl Owens, former Orlando Sentinel editorial writer. Now he's communications director at Beacon College. Welcome back, Daryl.
Thank you, Matthew. Good to be back.
And you can join us. We're at 1-866-338-5252. Is Governor Scott right on the money with his billion-dollar tax cut plan? Are you happy with the direction the state is heading in? And what of the legislation that's already rolling through the legislature? There's a water bill signed off by the Senate, showing perhaps there's less gridlock than last year, but is good legislation going to get passed? 1-866-338-5252. Matt Reed, we talked to Titusville Mayor Jim Tully on this program earlier in the week, and he highlighted the turnaround in the space program. So I'm just wondering if that kind of reinforces the governor's jobs, jobs, jobs message that we heard in a State of the State address.
It does a little bit. In Brevard County, where they've been trying to rebuild the space program and diversify and bring in new aerospace, Governor Scott's more popular and has been more effective than he generally gets credit for around the rest of the state. Mm-hmm. That's one reason why we endorsed him for governor back over Charlie Crist, narrowly. But I mean, that's his thing. He's big into economic development. He's put Brevard County and Cape Canaveral on the map for business relocations, that kind of thing. That's one thing that he's done well. So, mm-hmm. I guess he deserves credit where credit is due on that. And you're right. The space program is coming back, and we've found some ways through Space Florida to make that area more competitive.
Just talking about some of the other things that are happening in the next 60 days or so, some pieces of legislation is moving pretty quickly, the water bill, for example, but there are others that have stalled. There's one piece of legislation I wonder if you could talk about a little bit, Matt Reed. Now, your paper was championing this. It concerns corruption. Just remind our listeners quickly what that bill was and what's happening with it now.
Well, this is a bill we've been really pushing for. After 4 years of editorializing for this anti-corruption legislation that was recommended by the statewide grand jury, we decided to go ahead and have some model legislation drafted by a Melbourne attorney, Michael Kahn, and we got some sponsors for it. Mm-hmm. What this bill would do is take two recommendations from the grand jury. It's been endorsed by all 20 state attorneys. It would take away an unusual barrier in Florida on prosecutors that they prove not only that somebody knowingly took a bribe or took a kickback or tampered with bids, but they did so with corrupt thoughts or intents, which all but requires a confession.
Right.
That is why so often prosecutors do not prosecute in Florida. The other thing that would do is for the first time, it would hold contractors who take over major parts of government, like prisons or probation services, that kind of thing. It would hold them accountable to the same laws. Today, they are mostly exempt. Now, we've had to craft that law, or I haven't, the sponsors have,
right,
in a way that's very careful, that does not hold normal business practices and networking, to account. There's no gift ban in this. It doesn't create any new public records laws burdens. Mm-hmm. We had a scare on Monday. A Senate committee not only voted it down, but threw me and the bill out of the building, it seemed like. But it came back. Senator Gates, the sponsor, inserted it in some other legislation, which passed a committee in the Senate. So it's still alive there. And then Representative Rich Workman, the House sponsor, has worked very hard on that version of the bill. And it went to its first committee yesterday and passed 19-0. So we're very happy about that. Mm-hmm. For the first time in 5 years, we might see some significant anti-corruption legislation pass the House. And I'm really happy about that.
Matt Reed, let me just come back to what you were saying before. You and the bill were thrown out of the building. Now, there was criticism from Senator Jack Latvala to the extent that Gannett, the company you work for, and I guess you yourself, shouldn't be getting so hands-on and trying to shape policy as opposed just to reporting on it. And let me just quote something from the Tampa Bay Times. This is Steve Bousquet writing about this bill. He writes, quote, "It's highly extraordinary for a working journalist to actually lobby for or testify on legislation," end quote. You know, how do you respond to that, Matt Reed?
Well, the same way that I did on the record while testifying in the Senate, and that is that I simply brought the exact same message that I have written about repeatedly for years, and the same message that I have said on TV, on the radio, and in every public speaking engagement I could possibly book, I took it to a microphone in the forum where they were deciding on the bill, where they had to listen to me. Mm-hmm. So often, lawmakers can, you know, they'll see an editorial or they'll see a column and they say, you know, I'll cope with this now. And then they go to their safe space and they can ignore it. There were some reasons behind the scenes why some senators wanted to oppose this bill. And I got word as recently as Friday that this thing could be defeated for reasons other than the content of the bill. And I felt like I owed it to our readers that I had been defending and speaking up for to go and speak and share that message in that form as well. And I realize that that's unusual.
Yeah, it's
But we have – I have read and reread our code of ethics and checked my core values, and I believe that was the right thing to do.
Maria Padilla, I want to come back to the governor's state of the state, the message he took to lawmakers. The idea of a state safety net as a last resort and a job is the best kind of social intervention. I'm wondering if you look at, for example, the Latino community in Central Florida, how does that message play with them?
I think that's an important message because Florida has – there are like one, two, three, four different Floridas depending on who you are. And for the very well-to-do, these are the best of times in many ways. The economy is going very well for them. But if you are in the middle or toward the bottom of the economy, it's much harder for you to get any traction. So it's important to keep talking about that safety net because, by and large, Florida doesn't have very much of a safety net. And we do have a lot of newcomers here. Every year, Florida grows by population. This is what our economy is all about. And not all of those people are going to do extraordinarily well. Some people come here with the best of intentions and then things happen. Things or things don't happen, I should say, because it doesn't go as they had planned.
1-866-338-5252 is the number. Which kind of Florida, which Florida are you living in? And should jobs be the number one priority of the governor? 1-866-338-5252. Just wondering how that message resonates with you and what you're looking for, what you want to see out of this legislative session, what kind of laws, etc. Maria, several hundred people headed up to Tallahassee to protest this week to support supporting bills on either side of the immigration issue. One bill aims to stop local governments from creating so-called sanctuary cities as safe havens for undocumented immigrants. Just how important do you see the issue of immigration being this session, this legislative session in Florida?
Well, I think it's probably going to be very important precisely because of that bill about sanctuary cities. And my understanding of that is that it aims to hit mostly counties and municipalities in South Florida who have become sanctuary sites financially by penalizing them for being sanctuary cities or sanctuary counties. And what sanctuary designation does, what it means is that the local law enforcement is not going to cooperate with federal immigration laws or officials or whatever to let them do their jobs. That's supposed to be a federal a job anyway, not a local priority. And I think what the legislature is trying to do is clamp down on that and get them to cooperate with federal immigration officials. I don't know how that's going to work out. That's a big issue, much bigger, obviously, in South Florida than it's probably going to be in Central Florida,
right,
but important nonetheless.
Well, earlier we heard Athenia Joyner's response to the governor's state of the state. Here now is Mark Pafford. He's the House Minority Leader.
He wants a $1 billion tax cut, but it's a political stunt, not leadership. Evel Knievel would be proud, but Evel Knievel also broke a lot of bones along the way. His trickle-down corporate welfare plan makes you pay about $400 million extra in property taxes this year to pay for that corporate welfare. Hard-working homeowners shouldn't be writing checks to executives at already profiting corporations.
Darrell Owens, I want to bring you in the conversation. The $1 billion tax cut, of course, something very, very important for Governor Scott. He's now touring the state in a bus promoting that. Do you get the sense, Darrell Owens, that that's kind of resonating with Florida residents?
Well, Matthew, I'm reminded of something those brilliant economists, the Beatles, analyzed. Let me tell you how it will be. There's one for you, 19 for me, because I'm the tax man. Absolutely, the romantic notion of a tax cut is something to which taxpayers are attracted. However, I'm not sure Floridians are thrilled about this $1 billion tax cut that's meant to stimulate job creation that, at best, is supply-side economics in an economic climate where too many businesses continue to play Scrooge McDuck and sit on soft piles of cash.
Darrell Owens, typically a governor's address will cover a bunch of different issues. The governor was pretty focused on jobs. He sort of veered a little bit into talking about national security. But were you surprised that he didn't mention things like education, some of those issues?
Well, to be fair, Scott did mention education in his speech. He noted, quote, record high investment in our education system so that every child can have the opportunity to pursue the American dream, unquote. But, of course, that fiscal recalibration, which was undertaken after a series of deep budget cuts, didn't buoy Florida up to the high water mark in education spending in recent history. And given that Scott never again mentioned education in this speech, suggested the governor believes everything's now sunny with education in the Sunshine State.
Well, I want to just talk quickly about something else that's been happening this week concerning the legislature before we move on. A water bill is passing through, moving through the legislature. Not a lot got done last legislative session. So, Matt Reed, the fact that a bill is signed off on by the Senate in the first few days, that's got to be a good sign for a more harmonious session, better relations between the two houses in the state legislature and perhaps the governor as well.
Yeah, it was so surprising that things broke down as much as they did between the House and the Senate when you had two leaders like Steve Crisafulli from, you know, the Speaker from Merritt Island and Andy Gardner here in Orlando. They're close. They're both gentlemen. They're both regarded as very cooperative people. And then there was just this acrimony that things got out of hand with the health care. Water bill sounds really boring, but it's a super big deal. And it's one of Steve Crisafulli's top priorities. It's how we're going to set priorities and make sense of all the money that's coming in to finish doing the Everglades. And then hopefully start directing some Amendment 1 dollars into other types of projects like helping fix the Indian River Lagoon in our area. So that's a big deal. To be able to get that done is a big deal. And then the other thing that Andy Gardner's been championing is this bill that would create new education opportunities and jobs and academies for people with special needs at universities and throughout. And it's just a big deal for him because he's been raising his son with special abilities. And so to be able to at least get those two things done is a very nice – it's not just a nice symbol. It actually gets some things done of substance that it's hopeful.
Darrell Owens, hate to pour cold water on this, so to speak, but environmentalists are sounding a note of caution about this water bill. Is there a risk that we could end up with some legislation that isn't quite up to snuff just because lawmakers want to get it through quickly?
There certainly is good potential for that. Given the increasingly dire supply and water quality issues plaguing Florida and our ever-increasing population, expectations last year were that lawmakers would craft measures that crack down on water pollution and groundwater extraction. But after last session's premature adjournment, lawmakers may simply be satisfied getting any measure, even a watered-down one, on the books.
I want to go to the phones now. We've got Rich calling from New Smyrna Beach. Rich, what's on your mind when you reflect back on the first week of this legislative session?
Hi, Matthew. Great show. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Corey.
My issue has been with the jobs, and the way that the Republican legislatures and Republican governors try and go about doing it. I mean, reducing taxes on companies or businesses, that's a classic trickle-down economics, and it just it's been proven that it does not work. What people need is money in their pocket to spend and support the businesses, and that's what will make the businesses expand.
Mm-hmm. But isn't the argument, Rich, from the governor, other people who support this, is that, you know, if you encourage more companies to come here, you boost that sort of job base, then you are giving people an opportunity and giving them a chance to get some more money in their pocket and keep the cycle going?
Well, that's one way to look at it, but I would, like to see some other sort of, stimulus for the working people. I've been out of work now for 6 months, so...
What are you looking for? What are you hoping that lawmakers might do to help folks who are in your situation?
That's a tough question.
Yeah.
I just don't see them focusing on it, as much as focusing on, cutting taxes on businesses and, not helping people like myself get re-employed.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, it's certainly tough out there if you don't have a job, if you don't happen to be fortunate to be in that position. Rich, thank you so much for your call. I do appreciate it. Maria, I just want to turn this to you. I mean, the jobs message, as the caller pointed out, it's good if you're in a certain position, but for folks who are still looking for work, sometimes that doesn't resonate.
No, I empathize with Rich because I've been in his position, so I tell Rich to hang in there and to keep pounding the pavement. I know that's not enough, but that's essentially all you can do. And I understand what he's saying, because you have to differentiate between the number of jobs, which Rick Scott has created many, many jobs during his tenure, and the quality of those jobs. And what we're seeing is that we're spending lots of money and incentives to bring companies here, but they're not necessarily creating really high-paying jobs or jobs with benefits. What we're doing is basically multiplying the part-time job economy that does not pay benefits and so on and so forth. And I'm not sure how much that helps. It might help dig you out of a hole temporarily in terms of earning money, but I don't know what it does for your overall economy in the long term. I don't find that very helpful.
Mm-hmm. As Matt Reed was pointing out, on the Space Coast, some of those jobs are obviously pretty good, the engineering, the kind of high-tech jobs. So it kind of depends on where you are in Florida and I guess what sort of state you are in your own career too. Well, you're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. When we come back, we're going to talk about some other legislative issues. The Supreme Court in an 8-1 decision ruling Florida's death penalty unconstitutional. So what does that mean for the hundreds of people on death row? And big grey animals on land and sea. Ringling says from May, the circus will be no place for elephants. And a Brevard County Commissioner says maybe it's time to take another look at those rules that tell boaters to slow down in some areas so as not to harm those manatees. Boaters, does that sound like a reasonable plan? How onerous are those no-wake signs? And are you worried about what will happen to the manatees if the signs go away? We're at 1-866-338-5252. Taking your calls. Intersection, we'll be back in a minute.
Support for 90.7 News comes from Florida Hospital, presenting a new 12-story women's hospital filled with experts in preventative health, personalized maternity services, and the highest level of specialty care, all in one place. Florida Hospital for Women, because women are one of the reasons life is amazing.
Good morning. You're listening to Intersection. Thanks for joining us on your Friday morning. I'm Nicole Creston. You can take us with you anywhere you go throughout the day by downloading the WMFE mobile app. It's free for Apple and Android devices. Just search WMFE in the App Store or Google Play Store.
Support for 90.7 News comes from PNC Wealth Management. The PNC team can provide insights that help customers make the most of their wealth. More information is available from Eric Summer at 407-428-3087.
Welcome back to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. In the studio with me, Matt Reed with Florida Today and Maria Padilla with Orlando Latino Blog. And on the phone, we have Daryl Owens, Communications Director from Beacon College. And you can call us. We're at 1-866-338-5252. Now, if you've been to the circus, chances are you might have seen some elephants performing. But public opinions are changing, and so are the circus acts. Ringling Barnum & Bailey says it will retire its performing elephants by May. It's a couple of years earlier ahead of schedule than they said they would. Is that a good move for the circus? Is there an upside to elephants on parade in the circus? 1-866-338-5252. If you are a circus goer, are you going to miss seeing those elephants? Now, the retired elephants will go to Ringling Centre for Elephant Conservation. That's out in Polk County. Here's what Ringling's Director of Animal Stewardship, Janice Area, said about the end of the elephant shows.
Having had years of experience of seeing people respond as they do to the sight of an elephant, let alone a few elephants, let alone a line of elephants, I know that people will miss that.
So, Daryl Owens, I want to ask you, I mean, Ringling said that it was phasing out the elephants. It sort of made that pretty clear not too long ago, but at a slower pace. I'm wondering, is it a shock that although they decided to close the elephant show, that they said they were going to do a lot sooner?
Not at all. There's a rising hue and cry against the use of animals as Shanghai performers, evidenced most vividly by the continuing backlash against SeaWorld in the wake of the Blackfish documentary. Ringling simply read the tea leaves and recognized the waning taste for pachyderm performers as just a sign of the times.
Mm-hmm. Can the traditional circus survive, though, without some of those trappings of performance, like the elephants, like some of those other animals? And when was the last time you went to the circus? And if there are elephants performing, what was going through your mind as you were watching those pachyderms? To quote from Daryl Owens there, 1-866-338-5252. Matt Reed, the Florida Today editorial board, wrote last year about the decision to phase out those performing elephants, giving Ringling a thumbs up for the move. Were you expecting this kind of accelerated timeline for that?
Not exactly, but you know what? I have a theory, and I think that there is not a business case anymore for having animals in circuses, not just elephants, but maybe tigers and other animals as well. You know, in the age of video, and we can all see amazing video of animals in the wild,
right?
That, you know, these circuses got started at a time when that's the only way that you could see these animals. They'd travel from town to town, and you'd see them, and it was amazing, and you'd see that.
This was before National Geographic Channel and other outlets like that, right?
Now it's old hat. If you go to Florida State University, they have a circus department and program up there that trains kids. I've gone to see their circus. I was amazed. It was great. And in the end, I walked out and went, hey, wait a minute. No animals, mm-hmm. right? You see Cirque du Soleil and La Nuba do so well. Mm-hmm. People are really showing up to see amazing acrobatics and that kind of thing. And I'm not sure the animals sell as well as they used to. And they still cost a lot. And they're politically unpopular.
Mm-hmm. Maria Padilla, can the traditional circus survive? Or is this kind of the beginning of the end of them? Do they have to move to a more nouvelle form of circus like Cirque du Soleil that Matt was talking about?
I agree with Matt Reed on this and with Daryl as well. I think that the circus needs to be reimagined for today's audience, for today's generation. I went to the circus as a girl myself. I was taken to the circus by my parents, and I was very impressed with that. And I took my own daughter to the circus when she was 4 or 5 years old. The last time I went to the circus was maybe about 5 years ago. And I have to tell you that I was extremely uncomfortable being there. I no longer felt the same way about it. It wasn't charming anymore. And I thought, I'm never coming back. Mm-hmm. And I've never gone back. I don't find that funny anymore. I think most people don't find it amusing to be amused by animals who are in captivity that way. And as Matt was saying, maybe what we need to do is reimagine this with a maybe IMAX theater and this wonderful sort of 180-degree screen, and you're seeing this really up close, maybe in 3D. And no animals have to be in captivity for this.
Mm-hmm. More human cannonballs.
human cannonballs. Yeah, that's a possibility. They're going to go to the phones here. We've got Ryan calling from Winter Park. Ryan, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I guess I'm kind of preaching to the chorus here. It sounds like everyone's kind of in agreement that using animals in entertainment, specifically elephants in the circus, is kind of an outdated and cruel thing. So I applaud Ringling. I guess what I'd like to add is I hope companies like SeaWorld right here in Orlando will follow suit. The last speaker, I think, put it great. Environmental education conservation outreach and things like that can be achieved much better through, you know, the really cool things we have in technology these days. If we imagine going to SeaWorld and seeing the highest tech multimedia of orcas in the wild instead of an orca in a small pool jumping through a hoop. So I think the public is there. I just hope these companies that are still clinging to the idea of capturing and breeding these majestic wild animals follow suit. Mm-hmm. The only other thing I'd like to add is one thing I hope you guys will discuss and look into if you have time this hour. Ringling has definitely made a good decision, but where the elephants are going isn't perfect. It's kind of halfway there. It's not all the way there. It's a quote-unquote sanctuary in Florida. I think it's called something Center for Elephant Conservation.
Right.
It's owned by Ringling. They're going to do research on the elephants, and I think they're going to continue to breed the elephants. That's not a true retiring. It's not a true sanctuary. There's a place, I believe it's in Tennessee, that's a true elephant sanctuary, probably one of the best in the world. So I hope Ringling will, you know, continue on kind of their ethical path and, you know, let these elephants rest and take them out of the idea that they can still be used for economic gain.
Ryan, thank you so much for your call. I do appreciate it. They're going to go to another call here real quick. We've got Jenny calling from Orlando. Jenny, what's on your mind?
Hi. I just wanted to say that I'm really, really happy that they have decided to retire the elephants. Mm-hmm. Our family doesn't support using animals in shows. We have not been to see the elephant shows. We don't go to SeaWorld to see the animals in SeaWorld. We live in Orlando, so we're really lucky to have other opportunities. We go to see Cirque du Soleil La Nuba. We go to see Blue Man Group.
Right.
If something else were to start touring without animals, we would go to see that circus probably.
Mm-hmm. Jenny, thank you so much. Sounds like folks are kind of applauding Ringling here. Just want to come back to the point that was made by a previous caller there, Ryan, talking about SeaWorld. Matt Reed, obviously, opinions are kind of changing, and SeaWorld, you know, they are incorporating some of that high-tech stuff that the caller was talking about with some of their displays, but it's a slow path sometimes.
Yeah, I think it's even harder for SeaWorld and its orcas to figure out what do you do with animals if they're not performing anymore. I mean, it's not like you've got acres of farmland where orcas can go splash around. I mean, and some of them have spent their entire lives in captivity. They can't go into the wild necessarily. I don't know what you do, and especially with SeaWorld that is so focused its entertainment and its brand around that. I think it's going to be tougher for them than it will be for Ringling Brothers in this. But you know what? Maria mentioned something that I thought was really a cool idea. Was what if these, you know, both the circus and SeaWorld really get into IMAX or film, or you know, have an offshoot that capitalizes on their brand and their interest in these animals, but brings it to the public in another way to make money and to also, with SeaWorld, to further their mission to appreciate and help wildlife.
Mm-hmm. There are definitely some high-tech opportunities there. A lot of money, I guess, involved in setting these up. I mean, the companies that do them well, they're behemoths, right, like Disney, et cetera. So there's a ways to go, but some good ideas there. I want to talk now about manatees. Now, Brevard County Commissioners want the Florida Legislature to review provisions of the Florida Manatee Sanctuary Act, which sets boat speed zones along the Indian River Lagoon, among other places. Commissioner Kurt Smith says they want to see a study to see if these zones have any impact, if at all, on manatee deaths. There's also a couple of bills in the legislature which call for another look at those speed restrictions. Well, is this a good idea, or is this kind of rolling back years of protection for these creatures? That's what groups like the Sierra Club say. What are your thoughts? 1-866-338-5252. Matt Reed, this is in your neck of the woods. Why does Kurt Smith want to give these rules a review?
Well, Kurt Smith is a boater and an avid personal watercraft user. And like a lot of boaters, you know, it's a hassle. It's difficult when you want to go out and enjoy the river to, you know, spend much of your time kind of putting along at idle speed. You know, if you're trying to go fishing someplace, it takes a long time and a lot of fuel to get to where you need to go because of these manatee zones. There's always been a hue and cry among boaters who think that these manatee zones are unreasonable. On the other hand, the fact that manatee populations have rebounded at a time when their food source, the seagrass, has been suffering because of pollution speaks worlds about the protection. And it does seem a little odd that the minute the population rebounds, you take away one of the key measures that seems to have helped them. And if you've ever seen the back of some of the manatees, I mean, you can see them cut up from propeller props.
They are pretty scratched up, yeah. And just back to SeaWorld, I mean, they do have some of those rescued manatees. You can see them there. That there are, you know, can see them up close, the effects of those boat propellers.
Yeah, I've been in a boat that hit a manatee once going full speed, and it was shocking. I mean, this poor manatee was out in the middle of one of the navigation channels, so it wasn't – we weren't speeding. I was a passenger. Mm-hmm. And it was – you would have thought that we hit the Rock of Gibraltar. I mean, it's a tremendous collision, and the poor animals. Look, I mean, we've got to be smart about this. They're just calling for study, and we've got to be very cautious.
Mm-hmm. What's your sense, Matt Reed, of whether these signs could go away, though? I mean, is there a hue and cry out in Brevard County from folks who say this is a bad idea?
To make the manatee zones go away?
Yeah.
It's always been a battle. There are many passionate defenders of the manatees. Count me among the people who tends to side with being protective of the animals. But there has also always been that lobby from the boaters and the fisher people. I think that I think a study is probably okay. I don't think we're ever going to see manatee zones go away in the canals, for example. But there could be some places that we talk about reducing the size of the manatee zones out in the main Indian River Lagoon.
Mm-hmm. Maria Padilla, I just want to come back to a point you were making about the circus. Now, clearly in Florida, we've got a bunch of animals that you can see in their native habitats. I'm wondering if traditional avenues like the circus are going away, more people are going to flock to these opportunities to see manatees in the wild.
If you've ever seen a manatee in the wild, it's a wonderful sight. Every year, about this time of year, actually, in January, February, I go out to the Canaveral seashore. Mm-hmm. And there's a little spot there where you could stand on a kind of little bridge, not even a huge spot, where you can see the manatees come practically right up to you. They're huge. And they're lovely. And some people think, well, they're ugly. You know, mm-hmm. Different strokes for different folks. But I think they're an attraction. This is an animal that is in Florida that people from all over, when they come to winter here or they come to vacation here, would like to see. And I think that study that the legislator is calling for ought to be very careful with that, because it could open the door to something that we really don't want. And as Matt was saying, just when the numbers are rebounding, because we do have manatee counts every year, mm-hmm. I think it's Save the Manatee who does that. And why take a few steps back at a moment where we are really doing much better with this? And it took a long time just to get those protections for mm-hmm. the manatee on the lagoons and so forth. Why go back?
Mm-hmm. So a note of caution there from conservation. It's going to take a call here. We've got Beth calling from Orlando. Beth, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. There's an issue the commissioner didn't even consider.
You're talking about Kurt Smith?
Kurt Smith, yes. Mm-hmm. The majority of the manatee zones are in shallow waters. The issue he had is actually with those deeper areas that
right.
are in channels.
Mm-hmm.
The properties that are on those channels would see a lot more erosion mm-hmm. if the boats actually were to get up on plane. Greater wave action. I mean, he hasn't even addressed that. There would be property loss.
Mm-hmm. So are you saying, Beth, that some property owners might be kind of thinking about this idea and having a pushback for it for reasons other than just save the manatees?
Well, if they're not, they should.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you look at Sykes Creek, which was one of his areas he had an issue with, or the Sebastian River, you know, it's very narrow. You get some of these bigger boats up on a plane, they are going to have huge wakes on them, mm-hmm. and there is going to be property loss.
Beth, thank you so much for your call. Matt Reed, is that something that property owners in the Brevard County area are aware of and thinking about?
Well, I'm sure that property owners who live on the water probably appreciate that it's quiet and there aren't the wakes. But that hasn't been part of the discussion publicly thus far. What we've mainly seen is the usual concern and hue and cry from boaters who want to be able to get to where they're going faster versus people who have a passionate interest in protecting those manatees.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to just move on now. Before we go to a break, I want to talk about a story about the death penalty. Now, the Supreme Court says Florida gives too much authority to judges in delivering the sentence, and that makes it unconstitutional. That decision coming down earlier this week. Currently, the jury can recommend the death penalty, but it's up to the judge to actually impose it. Well, constitutional or not, what are those ramifications of that ruling? There's already controversy over the kinds of drugs used to execute prisoners. So could this be a start of a change in how Florida deals with its worst criminals? Daryl Owens, is this cause for celebration, that decision coming down from the Supreme Court of the United States, or is this kind of premature?
Well, I suppose we'll have to wait and see what the state comes up with in its rewrite of the Florida death sentencing statutes. For years, the state has flouted the Sixth Amendment, which puts the onus on juries, not judges, as Justice Sotomayor wrote, to, quote, find each fact necessary to impose a sentence of death, unquote. Mm-hmm. State Attorney Pam Bondi has said she'll work with state legislators to ensure that these changes that they make are in compliance with the high court ruling, so I guess we'll have to wait and see.
Mm-hmm. Let me just read an excerpt from a Palm Beach Post editorial on what the Supreme Court decision means. Quote, the number of minorities sentenced to death in Florida remains so disproportionate to their size of the population. Florida has had 26 wrongful convictions that resulted in death sentences, the most of any state, and the state hasn't even been competent at executing inmates, end quote. A lot to ponder there. Daryl Owens, is this a chance, do you think, to make some real change and right some deep inequalities in the justice system?
Well, it's certainly a chance, but the state has had a number of opportunities in the past. After all, 10 years ago, an American Bar Association study looking at the death penalty here in Florida cited fundamental flaws in the state's process for capital cases that lawmakers had failed to address. And one of the chief failures and one of the chief fundamental flaws was the disproportionate number of minorities among the condemned. So state legislators have known about this issue for a number of years. As I said, that was back in 2006, and they've yet to address those problems. So one would hope that once again, given the opening, they'll walk through the door and make some changes that addresses this issue.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. Still to come, hispandering. What is that word? What does it mean? Why are some political commentators saying there's more of it about this year? And what about that colossal lottery prize which got split three ways, including in Florida, dashing the hopes perhaps of millions of ticket holders? So maybe there's a lesson here, though, beyond the simple laws of probability. Intersection returns in a minute.
Support for 90.7 News comes from Verplu & Lumpkin, attorneys at law, representing individuals and corporate policyholders in disputes with insurance companies. The firm is pleased to announce the opening of its new office in downtown Orlando. Verplu & Lumpkin is a proud sponsor of public radio on WMFE, vpl-law.com.
Good morning. This is Intersection. I'm Nicole Creston. In your forecast, warmer but rainier conditions today with afternoon highs in the mid-70s and scattered thunderstorms expected throughout the day. Overnight lows in the upper 50s. For the weekend, skies clear out and temps climb just a little bit for Saturday into the upper 70s.
Support for 90.7 News comes from Dottolli Cancer Center, proud to support public broadcasting for more than a decade. Dottolli Cancer Center in Sarasota offers men a non-surgical solution to prostate cancer at first diagnosis or for a recurrence. More at DATTOLI.com.
Welcome back to Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. In the studio with me, Matt Reed from Florida Today and Maria Padilla with Orlando Latino Blog, and on the phone, Daryl Owens, Communications Director with Beacon College. Hispandering, it's one of those portmanteau words that sprung up in stories about politics recently, but what does it mean? Broadly, pandering to the Hispanic community, specifically voters. Latino and Hispanic voters are an increasingly important part of the electorate, so of course there are those who are running for office and they will reach out to them, but depending on how they do it, sometimes that effort can backfire. Just look at Hillary Clinton's campaign and the Abuela message. That didn't go down too well. So what's your impression of hispandering? Are politicians going to wise up and stop doing it? And what would you like to see them focus on instead? We're at 1-866-338-5252. Just want to play a little bit of sound here. Intersection talked to the mayor of Kissimmee, Jim Swan, earlier this week. He's not running for re-election, but he's keenly aware of the changing demographics of Kissimmee. And here's what he had to say.
And there's a lot of new folks who have moved here that I haven't had a chance to meet yet. And maybe they don't speak English, and I don't speak Spanish. But to me, the key is, am I providing an equal level of service to each and every citizen that we have in this community. And I believe this city breaks its neck trying to do that every day.
Maria Padilla, I just wonder what you make of that comment from Jim Swan. Is that kind of the opposite end of the spectrum from his pandering?
Yes, it is, and I compliment him because I think that's exactly what you need to do. What taxpayers of all stripes want is their money's worth of whatever services cities or counties or state governments provide. Mm-hmm. They don't really need abuela messages, as Hillary Clinton did. And I understand that it's well-meaning, and the people are striving to make a connection with an emerging population group and whose language may be somewhat different, even though the majority of Latinos in this country do speak English. Sure. And do understand English. But I think you just have to be careful how you do it. Latinos are no different from anybody else. They want what everybody else has. Mm-hmm. You know, they want the same things.
Mm-hmm. We had the State of the Union from President Obama, the last one he's delivering earlier this week, and there was the response, of course, from the Republican Party. There was a two-part response, one speech from Nikki Haley, governor of South Carolina, and then there was the Florida Congressman Mario Diaz-Balart's response in Spanish, which was similar, except it had a different message on immigration. What did you think about that?
I give that a thumbs down. As you may recall, I was the founding editor of El Sentinel, which was the Spanish language newspaper of our Orlando Sentinel, for 3 years. And I always monitored very closely that what we said in the Spanish language paper was not going to be different from what the Orlando Sentinel was saying, and vice versa. I think that what's good for one audience is good for another. And it was, I thought, very disingenuous, because Nikki Haley's message was a little bit stricter, a little bit harsher than Diaz-Balart's message. And he softened it. He kind of softened the edges around it. And I'm not quite sure that's as truthful. It wasn't a strict interpretation or translation of what the South Carolina governor said.
Mm-hmm. Do you think, or do you get the sense, as we were, you know, months out, many months, but it doesn't seem like that long away from the presidential election, do you feel that election campaigns are going to get a little more nuanced in how they tailor their message or reach out to those communities?
Yes and no. I think the short term, people may get desperate. On the Republican side, for instance, you do need at least 40% of the Hispanic vote in order to win the presidency. That had been pretty well established. And, of course, the last few contenders have not reached that. The last person to reach that was George W. Bush, who did get an astonishing 40% or so or more. So what measure of desperation you have to reach the Latino audience, I don't really know. But a lot of it also depends on your knowledge and your day-to-day contact with that segment of the population. If you have meaningful contact with any segment of the population, I think you are going to be a little bit more nuanced, because you know people, mm-hmm. you know individuals, rather than treating everyone as a group. If you don't, then we're going to see a lot more hispandering.
Mm-hmm. Darrell Owens, let me bring you in on this conversation. What are you seeing in terms of how campaigns are trying, whether successful or not, to reach out to minority voters, whether they speak Spanish, whether they're, you know, other communities?
Well, hispandering is a new word, but it's not a new game, as you know, Matthew. Campaigns have always tried to varying degrees of success to try to connect with constituencies that are alien to them. Republicans fairly unsuccessfully, save for George W. Bush, have tried to boost their numbers among black voters, often in ham-fisted ways. Given Americans' changing demographics, you're seeing and will continue to see candidates flopping about uncomfortably like fish out of water trying to win minority votes.
Mm-hmm. Is it a dangerous tactic for candidates?
Certainly, it has the potential for blowing up like TNT in their face. And you mentioned Hillary Clinton earlier. Secretary Clinton is an interesting case study. You remember back in 2007, during an appearance at a black church, she was she affected a Southern drawl and quoted gospel singer James Cleveland declaring, "I don't feel no ways tired," like that. And she got trolled for that. But here she is again trying the same thing in a Hispanic community. So you see that whatever pushback she received hasn't stopped her from playing the game. So maybe the point is it's perhaps less the mangled message than the messenger who's delivering the message.
Mm-hmm. Matt Reed, I wonder what your thoughts are on this. What about those candidates who go out of their way not to play to minority concerns? Is that the way to kind of counterintuitively reach some of those voters?
I think one of the lessons that I've seen from politics is that optics don't work that well. You know, that as Maria said, what some of the minority populations want is just to be treated with respect and to have opportunity. I'm a little bit surprised that Jeb Bush hasn't pointed to some of the things that he did that initially were unpopular but were kind of successful. For example, when he did his One Florida plan that was controversial because it did away with affirmative action in colleges, the other part of that plan was that he modernized the definition of minority contracting in Florida, for example. Mm-hmm. Prior to that, Hispanics and Latinos were not considered minorities. Only African Americans were. And so when they updated that, suddenly minority contracting exploded in Florida and opened up a lot of new opportunity for, you know, for Hispanics. That's the kind of thing that a candidate ought to point to on the campaign trail and say, look, I'm for real. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm here to help.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a campaign for the primary and then there's the general election campaign.
Right.
So he might be keeping some of his powder dry there. Mm-hmm. Well, I want to move on now and talk about that $1.5 billion that was up for grabs earlier this week. It's now being split three ways, or more ways than that, but the bulk of it, three winners there, the Powerball lottery. A Florida ticket holder, in fact, somebody from Central Florida was one of the winners. Millions disappointed, maybe not. Maybe it's the dream that makes it all worthwhile. Well, if you played, what would you have done with the money? 1-866-338-5252. That number again, 1-866-338-5252. Matt, one of the winning tickets sold in your neck of the woods. Does a big lottery win do much of anything for a community? I'm just wondering what the response has been in Brevard.
Think of the economic impact if this person starts throwing money around in Brevard County. It'd just be fantastic. You know, it's funny because we don't know who the winner is yet. It was sold at a Publix in Melbourne Beach, which is actually a fairly affluent area. So people are saying, "Oh man, it's probably some rich guy, you know, won this." Mm-hmm. But I don't. I just there's so much excitement about this. People have been going down taking selfies at the grocery store of all things. I think it's just. I think the fantasy and the fun of having a shot at this, and now everybody wants to know who won it. I guess that's what it's really all about. It just seems amazing to me that you've got this redistribution of all of our money to one person through a lottery. It's, mm-hmm.
Did you play?
Yes.
What would you have done if you'd won?
I have no idea.
You probably wouldn't be here, though, right now. You would probably be outspending your millions.
That's right.
Daryl Owens, Florida's seen, at least in some circles, it's seen as an anti-gambling state, and yet lottery fever burned here just as fiercely as anywhere else. What does that tell you about the attitude to gambling from Floridians?
Well, I think it speaks to a certain Disney-esque dualism. We may not widely want casino gambling with its concomitant, seedy, smoke-filled rooms and red-rimmed eyes qualities, but grabbing a Slurpee and a quick pick at a 7-Eleven with a chance to win millions and tell one's boss to take this job and, well, you know the rest, that's clean. It's sanitized. It's palatable in family-friendly Florida.
Mm-hmm. Just coming back to something that Matt said about redistribution of wealth, I mean, are some communities more at risk to others when it comes to, I guess, if you want to call it lottery vulnerability?
Yeah, absolutely. Here in Florida, particularly in the poorest counties like Putnam County with low median household incomes and soaring poverty rates and lower education attainment, the pipe dream of winning a king's ransom can be downright alluring. We've all heard or even seen the poor standing in line, plunking down practically their entire paychecks in hopes of the ping pong ball bouncing their way.
Mm-hmm. Maria Padilla, you wrote about this in your blog. What were your thoughts on this massive lottery haul, the potential to win $1.5 billion?
Well, I think it's a pipe dream, but I think, as everyone here, Daryl and Matt have been saying, it could be fun as long as you don't gamble your entire salary on it, and as long as you don't have any expectation that you're going to win. But as Daryl was saying, there are folks who really are thinking that they're going to change their life circumstances with a $2 or $3 lottery ticket, and that becomes rather sad after a while. We've all been on a line mm-hmm. where you see somebody buying more than $100 worth of lottery tickets, or trying to get them verified, and it's horrible. It's really horrible, but there's a real dependency there. Lots of folks here are trying to look for ways to live a better life, and mm-hmm. instant money always sort of appeals to people.
Mm-hmm. Just in the last 30 seconds or so, Maria, I mean, the lottery does fund a lot of good things like education. So, you know, it's not just a simple, you know, it's neither good nor bad. It's a complex picture.
It is a very complex picture. The education funding is the do-goodism part of it, which is to say that you feel good by plunking down that dollar or two and someone is going to, you know, some county or some school district, your school district is going to be helped by that. Mm-hmm. At the other hand, we do have an over-dependence on lottery revenue in this state. Florida Lottery generates a great deal of money, billions of dollars, I think $29 billion so far. Mm-hmm. Mostly for education. And we do a lot of scratch-offs, which are now plentiful, and they also cost more. And I mm-hmm. believe there's a call now in the House to pull back on that because it is very exploitive in many ways.
Mm-hmm. We'll see what happens with that. Maria Padilla edits the Orlando Latino blog. Thank you so much for joining us, Maria.
Thank you.
We're also joined by Matt Reed, columnist with Florida Today, also the host of The Matt Reed Show. Thank you so much for coming in, Matt.
Always a pleasure, Matthew. Thank you for having me.
And on the phone, Daryl Owens, communications director for Beacon College. Thank you so much for joining us, Daryl.
Thank you, Matthew. Enjoyed it.
And support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. The executive producer is Catherine Welch. Production assistants from Nicole Chris and Amy Green, Alex Gasparini. You can tune to Intersection next Tuesday morning at 9. We'll take a look back at the civil rights movement here in Central Florida and look at where the movement is now. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.